That's dehydrated. Yeah, reconstituted.
Yeah.
And welcome everybody in attendance today. What I'd like to do, we'll take a, I think will be a short work session on Senate Bill 1115 first. That one will be the easiest for today. And then for those of you who are here on 408, it is work session. It's billed as work session, but I see enough folks in the room that I know we have some discussion about amendments. If you would sign up, and we'll go down the sign-up sheet, we'll conduct it as if it was a public hearing today. Neither one of these bills are going to move to a final vote today. We do have a meeting committee scheduled for Wednesday now to take back these bills again, take up these bills and a couple of other bills. So we will be looking probably at some final action on Wednesday. With that, let me begin with a work session on Senate Bill 1115. Mr. Taylor is not up to speed on this one.
Well, I do know about the Dash 3 amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, you do?
Yes.
Oh.
Well, I know they're here. I know they're in front of us.
Oh, they're here.
And I do know from the staff members who saw me, modify scope of public policy and statutes relating to organized labor in new labor disputes. And if I remember correctly, this goes back to Arundo v. Oregon Roses, a 1997 Court of Appeals case.
Okay. Thank you. And the amendments before us, I think... derived from some discussion we had last time. Actually, before let me correct myself. Before we move into work session, we need to go through the couple votes. And the first one will be to request unanimous consent to reconsider the vote by which we passed out Senate Bill 1115. Is there any discussion, any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The chair then would request unanimous consent to reconsider the vote by which we passed out Senate Bill 1115. Is there any discussion, any objection? So ordered. Okay, now we are in work session on Senate Bill 1115. And why don't we ask the three of you to come on up. Two of you. Okay, Mr. Bernasek, Commissioner Roberts. Representative Verbalow, we're on the amendments to 1115.
Chair Shelley, members of the committee, for the record, Tim Bernasek, Associate Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau, here just explaining the Dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 1115. These amendments were the result of some discussion that the committee had. There were some conceptual amendments made last time we considered this bill, and I followed up with discussion with Chair Shetterly and Vice Chair Herbalow to come up with some language that could maybe meet some of the concerns that some of the members of the committee brought up last time. The amendments, just to summarize them, we deleted on line 16 of the bill the language talking about the unlawful employment practice because an individual discusses or attempts to discuss wages and working conditions, and instead inserted the term engages in concerted activities. And then we added at the end of that section, we kept the language that it's an unlawful employment practice to discharge an individual because the individual engages in concerted activities at a time and place and in a manner that does not constitute a slowdown, strike, or substantial job interruption. And then we added the language to define what concerted activities mean, because there's a lot of baggage in the law defining what concerted activities really are. And there was a working group that Commissioner Roberts put together and worked in the interim, and they'd come up with some language defining what concerted activities were to mean, and that's what we inserted in this bill. So for purposes of the bill, concerted activities is to mean activities of employees engaged in with other employees for the purpose of addressing the terms and conditions of their employment with their employer. So that is the first main amendment that we made. The other major amendment is to allow a full private right of action in accordance with the normal BOLI procedures or the normal unlawful employment practice procedures in any other case. We had before reached, I think, an agreement or some compromise language on how they would, how an employee felt they were had been unlawfully discharged or had an unlawful employment practice committed against them, would go through a kind of finding of fact procedure with BOLI, and then if BOLI gave them the rubber stamp to go on to court, they could move on. And there was some concern by Representative Herbalow, and I think Representative Walker and Representative Lowe had some concerns about that procedure. So in subsequent discussions, we decided to just take out that hurdle and allow the same type of procedure, the private right of action procedure that all other unlawful employment practices under the Chapter 659 allow that same procedure here. So those are the two amendments that we made, and we hope that that meets the needs and concerns of the members of the committee.
Actually, there's one more. I think maybe you didn't touch on it, or if you did, I missed it, but that was the protected activity under Chapter 654.
Oh, that's right.
That's
page
2?
Yes, I'm sorry. That's right. That was one of the...
Right.
Yeah, I think that was one of the conceptual amendments that Representative Erbilau had, and that is, in fact, part of the bill.
Mr. Chair, amendment.
We don't.
Okay. I mean, they're passed. The bill's looking for some, I think.
Okay, Mr. Kappas, thanks. Commissioner.
Excuse me.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but also you took out about three words about the disrupt wording.
Yes, I'm sorry. Those, yes, we did. There was a concern at the last hearing about the definition of what would constitute unlawful employment practice, and one of the segments was that it does not disrupt work was one of the issues that was brought up, and so since there was some discussion about what would constitute a work disruption, we decided to just take that out. And so the bill, if you read it all together, that whole Section 7, Sub 1, should read now, it is an unlawful employment practice for an employer to discharge an individual employed in agricultural labor as defined in ORS 657-045 because the individual employee engages in concerted activities at a time and a place and in a manner that does not constitute a slowdown, strike, or substantial job interruption. And for purposes of this section, as used in this subsection, I'm sorry, concerted activities mean activities employees engaged in with other employees for the purpose of addressing the terms and conditions of their employment with their employer.
And I just want to comment, too, then, that we have gone beyond just discussing or attempting to discuss wages or working conditions, and it's my understanding that the language that we have in here now, activities engaged in with other employees for the purpose of addressing the terms and conditions, gets at, I think, some of the issues that were raised last meeting, such as the meeting of employees at another employee's home or the wearing of a button or something like that. And so that takes those issues off the table. Very good. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jack Roberts, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I certainly support the expansion here of the right of private action not coming to our office, but I think that's a real improvement. I also think the broadening under the concerted activities does help address some of the issues, as you point out, that were raised before. And I think under this, the way we would enforce this is that the activities that were discussed before of having meetings off-site and working together, whether you're on office business time or not, that would be protected. And so I think in this sense we have a broader range of activities that are protected, and that the reason for having our own definition of concerted activities is that it's the intent here not simply to buy into what is otherwise National Labor Relations Act language, which is generally, you know, collective bargaining. And this is a specific use of the term for this bill.
Representative Witt, welcome back to me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Roberts, is concerted activities defined in the bill?
Yes, unfortunately you don't have a copy of it, but I'll read you the definition. What it says on line 8 is it will insert, as used in this subsection, concerted activities means activities of employees engaged in with other employees for the purpose of addressing the terms and conditions of their employment with the employer.
He's going to bring you a copy. You took it away just as he was looking. Yes. No, because I took his. I took the old
copy. Do you need one, Mr. Chair?
No, I've got one.
Okay.
Somehow.
I got mine. No, you have to give me one back.
Please, those are the fives.
It's dash 5 we want. Then why do we have dash 3?
Those were last meetings. Oh, no, dash 3s, I think, were an intermediate amendment.
That's the one with the definition. Yeah. I got one, and...
Here's one.
Lane's got a dash five.
Well, we do things different over on the House.
I want to apologize. You can see we are out of shape. It's been a week since we've had a meeting. Are you finding something that you...
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wells.
Thank you. Could you please read that definition again, since I apparently don't have it?
You don't have a copy of it?
No.
It's on line 8 of dash 5. It says, in line 18, after the period, insert, and then this is the definition. As used in this subsection, concerted activities means activities of employees engaged in with other employees for the purpose of addressing the terms and conditions of their employment with their employer.
Ask a question.
Yes, sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In my conversations with you I indicated that I needed to, I was pleased that you had made so much progress in finding an accord on this, and I'm happy to see that. But again, I'm wondering what the position of the farm workers is and where their sticking point is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, I think that's a good question. We do have David Niebel from Oregon Law Center.
David, do you want to speak
here?
Come on up. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And David,
have you seen the dash fives?
I have not. To be fair, Commissioner Roberts showed them to me briefly just before the committee began. I have not been a party to these negotiations. My colleague, Mr. Dale, who appeared before the committee previously on this bill, I think has been a party to these negotiations, and I think that the sticking point, I think he agrees that there's been a lot of progress in the definition of concerted activities, and also he's pleased with the private right of action provisions of this of these amendments. I think the sticking point is the interruption of work activities. I think that's the part that the farm worker community is still having a problem with.
May I address that as one was involved, and I think Tim and I have talked about this. The issue that came up was that they recognized that it was important during harvest time to have stability for the farmers, but they also said the problem is these people are transient workers in the main. I mean, they're not regular workers. They're only here for harvest. If they didn't have some ability during harvest, whatever that might be, for a challenge, it would really be a worthless right to do anything outside of the harvest season. And so that was the sticking point, and that was kind of left at that point. And from my understanding, and Tim, you can speak to this better than I. It's my understanding that the Farm Bureau felt that it had done as well as it could, being able to protect its interests and its business. I understand that. And the farm workers wanted to look into it a little bit more. And it was kind of left there at that point. But they had that concern.
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead, Representative.
So what's going to happen next?
Well, what's going to happen?
More discussion about this.
Take a stab at that. What I'd like to do today is just move the dash 5 amendments in so they're in place. There will be some more discussion next week with Chip Lazenby and farm workers and Farm Bureau to see if they can achieve any closer consensus than what they have. And we will wait until next Wednesday's meeting when we meet again on Wednesday. And at that point, we will see if there is some consensus. Otherwise, then we'll just take action based on what we have in front of us. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize for this, but I also wasn't involved in negotiation. I just got a copy of this, and one issue I want to flag, because I think you might want to think about this if you're not taking action until next Wednesday. As I read this, you're replacing the language that said discusses or attempts to discuss wages and working conditions with engages in concerted activities. That is clearly broader if you're talking about more than one employee. I'm not sure, as it's written, that it would protect the individual employee who goes to complain to his or her employer, and I don't think it was the intent to remove that protection. And I'm wondering if it would make sense, rather than to delete discusses or intends to discuss, leave that and say, or otherwise engages in concerted activities. And then can bring that in. That might provide the broader range of protection that we wanted. And if you're not going to take final action until Wednesday, that seems to me you could do it.
In that case, then, rather than do some conceptual amending on an amendment that we may need to amend again next week, we'll just communicate that to Legislative Council and bring this back before us. But I wanted to have a chance to hear some preliminary response to the Dash 5 amendments. I do want to commend both sides, but in particular the Farm Bureau at this meeting for some substantial further accommodations that they have willingly made. I thought we had an acceptable bill last time. I think we're moving to a very good bill, and I appreciate your willingness to be receptive to the committee's concerns about this and deal with those amendments last time. And I'm hopeful that, at this point, I think we have met the governor's veto message from last session and gone substantially beyond that. And I hope that you'll be able to persuade the governor's office at some point, either as we stand or if there's some further accommodations that we can do, that this is a bill that really does meet the intent of his veto message from last session. Representative Werbelow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would echo what you said about working with both sides, and I just especially like to commend Tim. He's been very good to work with, and I guess we've tried to find grounds that we can come together on. I think, actually, I'm not sure if we went beyond the governor's. The governor raised 2 points. One was the private right of action, basically, and that is there, and concerted activity, and that is there. So I think we certainly, I would agree that at least the note that I saw from the governor, we've addressed those issues.
Thank you.
Okay, with that then, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 1115. And again, thank you very much. Tim, you want to double check with council at some point here, maybe the end of the day or Monday, to make sure we communicate the right change there to Legislative Council. Okay, and let's open a work session on Senate Bill 408. And Rachel, could I have the Senate sheet on that? Yes, Council, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 408 is a bill that comes to you as a result of what Congress did in November of 1997. Congress at that time overwhelmingly adopted the Adoption of the Safe Families Act. The act was intended to assist state efforts to balance family preservation and unification with health and safety of the child. It, among other things, allows the State Office of Service to Children and Families to enter into agreements with other states to provide adoption services, and it does a whole host of other things set forth in the staff measure summary. We have two sets of amendments before us today. One, I believe, comes from the Court Administrator's Office, the Dash 9, and the Dash 10, a conflict amendment.
I only have the Dash 10, Council.
I just passed that.
Me too.
I don't have the 9 either.
Oh, boy.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to be at two places at once.
Well, while we...
I have
the Dash 9s look pretty simple. Let's go ahead and take those up. The Dash 9s come from the court. Lift that.
Yeah, I just love this.
Oh, well, that's easy.
Can you pass them out when you're
done?
Wait till we... They should not move forward until we get the
Yeah.
Here they come. Oh, we're losing Representative Mannix to rules.
Who?
Oh, I'm sorry, Chief. Representative Max, I was thinking...
What a personal privilege.
You want to change your name? Last name?
I have to be in... I have to run the Rules Committee, but I will be back.
Is that
where we're at? No, he's out in the hall.
Okay. Now we all want to know what the Dash 9 amendments do, so for that, let's call up Timothy Travis, Brad Swank, and Judge Deanne Darling.
Chairman Chevrolet.
Sorry, committee members may remember that I introduced Judge Darling at the last joint Senate and House committee hearing on this as the mother of my daughter's heartthrob.
and the relationship progresses nicely.
Oh.
How did you vote on that notice? Never mind.
Yeah.
It was easy.
Chairman Chatterley and members of the committee, we are here to talk about what, after many months of hard work and much negotiation that resulted in harmony among the OJD and SCF on how to deal with the ASPA issues, has taken an unfortunate turn where we don't agree. And our position is that it is a very critical issue to be resolved. And to leave this issue unresolved is not fair to the children of today, who may be the orphans of tomorrow. And while you will hear each side, I think, tell you what their respective positions are and why, I think we come together telling you, decide it. Do not leave it for later. What the it is on Section 21, ASPA says that after a child's been in foster care 15 of 22 months, it's presumptively correct to move to terminate parental rights and find that child a new family. However, there are exceptions to that. One is that the child's in the care of a relative. The other is there's a compelling reason not to go forward, and there are others. In the language of the compelling reason, ASPA says that the compelling reason shall be available for court review. Every other step of a dependency case has judicial review. OJD, myself, most of the judges, Judge Harrell, who was the chair of the National Juvenile Court and Family Judges, who was himself involved in the drafting of ASPA when it was created at the federal level, assumed that the available for court review meant there was a court function beyond just going past my desk. I believe that SCF has a different interpretation on what that language means and what the court's function would be at that point. And that's what brings us here. I am convinced that if you don't resolve this dispute for us today, it will be resolved in the courts 4 or 5 years from now, because some judge will assume that if it's available for court review, it means I can say no, and we're not going here. And somebody will appeal that, and we will find out. And I implore you to make a decision on this matter now. I think you have Judge Harrell's email that sets out what his position is based on his work in the trenches when ASPA was adopted. I don't think I need to say my personal preference, and I believe the position of the Judicial Department and every juvenile judge I've spoken to, and there's quite a few of them. I'm also the chair of the Family and Juvenile Law section of the Judicial Conference, and I have 24 judges on that committee. And I haven't spoken to every one of them, but many of them support the position that we need to continue judicial oversight through the process. We have much oversight in the beginning. We have a lot of oversight at the end. Why would we not have it here? And we think the compelling reason not to do that which the Act presumes is the appropriate step is a critical piece for the court to review. So clearly our position is that the court should be involved in that process. If you disagree, I would request that you state that at this point, if there's not going to be a termination of parental rights, that the court has no further function in the case, and the agency may go forward and do as it sees fit without oversight. Why leave this ambiguous? If ever I waffled about the need to have this issue resolved, it was resolved in my mind last night. I attended an adoption party for Rose and Dustin. They were two kids who've been in foster care for 5 years, and at Christmas time their adoption was complete. I was the judge who was fortunate enough to be involved in the relinquishment, the termination, and the adoption, and could complete a long overdue process. The agency's position throughout the case, well, I can't say the agency's, I think the Attorney General's position throughout the case was they couldn't prove a termination of parental rights, and the child's attorney filed the petition. And he said, I refuse to give up. The CASA said, I refuse to give up. I know we can terminate rights. I know these kids don't belong with their mother, who they hadn't been with for years, and she'd been awful to them. And I know they're adoptable, and I know there's a resource, and we will find them a permanent home. I can't say I know for sure whether or not the agency disagreed with that, and that's not the point of this discussion. What the point of the discussion is kids want an end. And I hear over and over in my courtroom with the kids saying, I just want it over, I just want it over, I just want it over. And last night at this party, this 9-year-old and this 11-year-old came up and said to me, the greatest day in my life was the day it was over. And their teachers came up to me and said, I will never forget the looks on their faces when they came to school and said, it's over, it's final, I belong. That's not to say I disagree, that I'm not bringing this up to say the agency did wrong. That is not the point of it. We agree with the agency most of the time. The result, the point of the story is the only way we got to that result, and the agency joined in the end, was we kept having hearings and reviews and more information. And I believe that a view of the case occurred based on a known set of facts. And as we had a further hearing and got farther into it, more information came out. And as a result of that, we all ended up in the same place, which is the right result for kids. So I say court review is good because it puts one more head in it, and it gives one more opportunity for the rest of the sides to give us the information so we can make a good decision for these poor kids. Thank you.
Representative Woodland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, my question came about, in my mind, it's not directly related to what you want to do, but indirectly. As I went back and read that section, I noticed that when we talk about terminating, it says unless, and it has A and B, but I assume that A and B are not and. It's an or, but there's neither one of them there. Is that correct? I mean, it's either that they're being cared for by a relative,
Or there's a compelling reason.
Right. Actually,
and then if you go down
a
little,
on line 11,
right.
It's an or.
Right.
Correct.
But, and I see that, but I didn't know if that was... And I wanted to make sure for the record that these are three different reasons that the or under B on line 11 didn't belong on the seat.
I think we've
three different
Chairman,
reasons, right?
Chairman Chatterley, Representative Urbelo, I believe that everybody that's here to testify on this bill will agree absolutely
okay.
with that.
I just wanted to make that clear.
It seems to me we've asked or had that, but maybe not in this committee, but that's one of Legislative Council's drafting procedures. If it's
okay.
If it's I want to say this. If it's in the disjunctive, then or the conjunctive, why they put it at the end and it applies all the
case,
proceedings.
But it wasn't quite clear reading something. Mm-hmm. But now it is. So that's all I wanted to make sure.
Mr. Travis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we believe that 408, as written, describes a process that is what we want. However, our discussions with SCF and the Attorney General lead me to believe they do not believe that the language as written describes the process we want. That is why we wrote the amendment to make it clearer, if clearer it needs to be, what the process should be. I believe that the language in section 15 of the bill, on page 13 of the bill, beginning at line 2, it says the court shall enter an order within 20 days after the permanency hearing. When the child is in substitute care, the order shall include the court's determination of the permanency plan for the child. That includes whether, and if applicable, when. And then if you will look down at line 6, it says, the child will be placed for adoption and a petition for termination of parental rights will be filed. I do not believe the court can make that determination unless the court has already made the determination in section 21 about one of the three exceptions to the termination rule. So I believe that if you read these two statutes together, it is very clear that the decision about the exception to the 15 of 22 rule is a piece of the section 15 sub 5 decision. That is not how the agency reads this. That's why the language is amended as it is, to make it clear that that is the decision to be made and that the court is to make the decision. Now, I have given you a handout that I prepared to try to answer the basic questions about how this works, but I would like you to look at the flow chart that's part of my handout. It's back about 5 pages. It says ask the timeline. It looks like this. what it says is, or what it shows is, this very complicated graph, which I'm not going to lead you through. There is no piece of cheese at the end of this maze. I would like you to look, however, at the section on your chart that I have circled in yellow. It says permanency hearing in one box. To the right, it says 15 of 22 month exception to TPR. Below that is a box that says extend services for a specific time. And then to the right of that is a box that says disposition consistent with exception. This is in four different boxes, but this all happens in the same hearing. This is not going to cause another hearing to happen because the court is reviewing the 15 of 22 month decision. At the same time, it will not cause more work for the agency or the AG because, as I said earlier, they must prepare for the court to make the determination under Section 15 as to whether or when the termination will be filed. They already have to make the effort to persuade the court that their decision about the final plan for the child is a good one. There is no extra work involved. So that, in a nutshell, is where we're going with this thing, or why we're here to talk about this. I would like to underline what the judge said. If we leave this decision, or this language unclear, we're passing a lawsuit out of here. And it's not just a lawsuit that the state is going to pay for every lawyer on every side of it, but it's also a lawsuit that's going to hold up permanency for kids. The Adoption and Safe Families Act, the whole point of the Adoption and Safe Families Act is to expedite permanency for kids, not to slow it down. So we're asking that if you believe that OJD is wrong, then craft some amendments that make it clear. But if you leave it the way it is, there will be lawsuits on this question. The other thing I'd like to say is that we are making this bill consistent with the intent of Congress. Think about it this way. An administrative agency makes a final decision about how they're going to proceed on a child's life and on parents' life, involving people's liberty interest under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. We're not talking about a driver's license here. We're talking about constitutionally protected family relationships. The interpretation that SCF has made to me of this language is that the court has no power to ensure that when they made their decision, they follow the law. That can't be the intent of Congress. It cannot be the intent of Congress. So, although in the end, the court would have its say at the termination trial, that trial is a year down the line. That means that if the court decides, no, there shouldn't have been a termination, a whole year will have passed in the life of a child. Close your eyes and remember when you were 6 years old, and it was about this time of year, and you were getting out of school, and you had the whole summer in front of you. That whole summer seemed endless. For us, for me, a year passes in the blink of an eye. For a child, the developmental time of a year is endless, and it's crucial in terms of their development and their ability to bond. So we can't just say, well, the agency can go pursue a termination, and if they're wrong in a year, we'll find out. We need to know that now, and we need to know it up front. So, excuse me, my voice is failing. If there are any questions you have, I'd be glad to try to answer them. I'd also like to reserve rebuttal if I could for
Sounds like a court hearing here.
Chair Satterley, member of the committee for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. And I need to clarify first that I am not one of the members of the of our office who have been following this bill closely. I was approached this morning. It is a bill that has been being followed closely by a number of very capable people in our office, and judges who are associated with this bill. I was approached this morning by Timothy to ask if I would take a look at it in the fiscal impact to see if the discussion that was being, how I felt and what my reaction was in relation to the discussion about the Dash 9 amendments and whether or not additional hearings were created. So I agreed to do that, and I sat down this morning and took a look at our fiscal impact and how I thought the Dash 9 amendments would affect it and what I thought the ramifications of that were, and then I'm here this afternoon because I was requested to be here. So the first thing I'll say is that the initial fiscal impact that the Judicial Department put on this bill has essentially not changed since we put the fiscal impact on. We anticipated there would be some additional work generated by this bill, and we put that in our base budget because we knew that it was a way to access a large amount of federal money. And there has been no change in that fiscal. It was the monies necessary for us to implement this bill were included in our base budget, and our estimates haven't changed since that initial official fiscal impact. The amendments that are being discussed today do not change it. They don't add any hearings, as best as I can tell from my review, from taking a couple of hours out this morning to review it. And they don't change what the bill does. They're things that we anticipated from the initiation of this bill in our discussions over the past 16 months, and since this morning, since this was brought to me, I've engaged in both discussions with the Chief Justice and King Saclick on this issue, and the Dash 9 amendments don't have a fiscal impact for us. They do make clarification, and it's not just because Timothy is from the same office, and as you've just heard, is very persuasive when he makes an argument. It is an issue where you've got two agencies who are disagreeing about, or an agency and a branch of government who are disagreeing. Allow me to clarify. Disagreeing about whether or not there is authority for courts to review. My experience will tell me that if we are disagreeing, it is an area that it is an issue that somebody will take to court, and there will be challenges on it, and that may have some costs that we haven't anticipated, and it might be worth your while considering clarifying it. But in terms of the Dash 9 having a fiscal impact for us, they don't. And on review of Timothy's arguments, and looking at the bill and the sections of the bills that he pointed out to be this morning, it makes sense to me that those would be arguments that it shouldn't add additional time if you were bringing those cases, because those are things that you would have to be addressing in the permanency hearing at the time you're addressing that anyway. So as I say, I make it clear that my review has been short based on my experience and background, and that I was asked to do this morning. Those are my opinions of as I've expressed them, and I can answer any questions that you've got to the extent that I've reviewed the bill.
So this boils down to, on page 16 then, the proposition that you have brought to us collectively, to make explicit in section 21 that the proceeding in subsection 2 would be a court proceeding.
That's correct.
And that there would be no, to do that would result in no additional fiscal impact to the bill or any untoward caseload disruptions.
That's correct, Mr.
Okay.
Chairman.
Representative Whittle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, this is for anybody who wants to answer it, but I received this paper from the agency, and there are two issues that they raised that I'd like to have your response to. One is... And they are set out this statement from a comment section of the proposed rules published by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Unfortunately, they didn't put a cite there, but it's the comment, and I'll give you that later. But it said that the department said, we are not interpreting the statutory language, which requires the documentation of the compelling reason to be available for court review as a requirement that the court makes a determination with respect to the compelling reason. To interpret this language as requiring a court determination with respect to the compelling reason not to file a TPR would place an additional burden on the state agency and the courts. We do anticipate that the court will have the opportunity to review the compelling reason not to file a TPR as part of its ongoing oversight. So it looks like at least the Department of Health thought when it was looking at the statute and then promulgating rules that maybe they weren't going the same place. So if you could respond to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Overlaw, you are quoting from the comment section of a proposed and not final federal rule. And even if it becomes final in the form that it's written, the comment is not part of the rule. Okay. We have designed Oregon's ASFA system with the 12-month hearing and putting this decision in the 12-month hearing so that there is no extra workload. Okay. Now, I don't know how other states may have done it, although I do know that according to Steve Christian from the National Council of State Legislators, who was here and made a presentation, that every other state allows judicial review at this point in the case. But we have designed our system so that we do not have to call a special hearing. That's what that's talking about. They don't want the court to have to call a special hearing to review the compelling reasons. We're building that decision into an already existing hearing.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another concern they raised, and I'd like the response to it, it says the proposed language implies, and I assume they're talking about your dash nines, the proposed language implies that the state doesn't have to file a TPR if the court finds an exception exists. There's no such language in the Federal Act.
Well, that sort of begs the question of what the exception to the rule is for, if it doesn't excuse the state from the duty of filing a termination. Maybe I don't understand the question, but...
Well, I'm just using their language, and I'm asking. You all are much more aware of the rule than I am, and I'm just trying to get some response to their concern, and maybe they can explain it more clearly up here, and then you can
perhaps
respond.
They can.
Not rebut.
It just seems to me that if you have a rule and you have exceptions, the definition of the exception to the rule is that it excuses the duty that's created by the rule.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Representative Overlaw, if I could add on to that, I think we could look at it a different way. Whether ASFA requires us to do it isn't really the issue. Is this the way Oregon wants to do it? There's nothing in the Act that prohibits this, and if the agency's position is there's nothing that says you shall do it, so should we do it? And that's the decision I think we're asking you to make. And on a more practical note, if this isn't part of the review with the 12-month process, and it's a piece of paper that comes in, as only agencies can send in those pieces of paper, and it's available for my review, I think I'm pretty safe in saying on a day-to-day practical workload issue, it isn't really going to be reviewed. If it's not built into a court review where everybody can have input and bring things to the attention, not that I'm looking for any more work to do, but if it's somebody in my courtroom needing a hearing on the record versus reading an agency report, I know what I'm going to do. I read the agency reports and the CRB reports at midnight when I have time, and it's not the right way to do that, is a position.
And if I may take 30 more seconds, let me just illustrate what we're talking about here. We're talking about parents coming into court and asking a judge to say, or asking a judge, the agency says that there's no compelling reason in my case. The agency says they're going to file a termination. I think a compelling reason not to file a termination is this, that, and the other thing. The agency is saying that the judge cannot make a decision about that. That the judge cannot hear a parent's argument whether or not there's a compelling reason not to terminate. That's what the agency's argument is saying. That's wrong.
I think we could hear it. We just can do nothing about what we hear.
You could certainly, I guess that's what their definition of review is. You can hear it, but you can't disagree with us.
And this is more a comment as I was listening to Your Honor. I thought about this. I thought if the federal law does not prohibit Oregon from doing it a certain way, then our next question it asks is what works best for the child, not what works best. I'm sorry, for the agency or for the court, but what works best for the child. And I guess that's what I... my focus, as you all talk, is what I will be thinking about.
And Representative Blah, I think we all agree what is best for the child, and everybody comes at that from a different place, and that's why you have to make this decision for us. Please don't let the decision go. Whatever you decide, just decide.
Stick around. You can go back to your seats, but let's hear from Connie Gallagher, Bob Muir, and Linda Guss. No, it's not. Bob Mink. Sorry.
That's right.
Revenue. I was talking about anything.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Mink. I'm Deputy Director of the Department of Human Resources. And I'd just like to make a couple of broad comments and then turn it over to Connie and Linda to talk to you about the policy considerations. First of all, I agree with the judge when she said that we've all worked very hard on this. The good news is that we have worked hard on this bill, and almost everything we do agree. And both sides, I think, have the best interests of the children of the state in mind as we're working through this. So there were 13 different issues that we worked through over the last month or so and came to agreement on. This issue, however, we are disagreeing on. There are a couple of points here. One is that we need this bill. Committee counsel said that Congress passed this law and we need to comply with it this legislative session in Oregon. Unfortunately, it's an unfunded mandate from Congress. So there's more work for us to do. The second point is that because of the nature of this law, we're going to have over 3,000 children in Oregon which meet that standard of 15 months in foster care over the last 22 months. Of those 3,700 kids, 1,800 or so of them are going to require a determination very quickly. So one of the things you need to hear about is that there's a bubble of kids we've got to take care of right now, and then there's an ongoing workload in the future. We believe there is a fiscal impact on this. Now, we filed a fiscal impact on the bill, but we did not anticipate this amendment. So the fiscal impact we filed earlier does not anticipate this amendment. We filed an additional one for this, and that concerns us given the state of our budget right now, and already gone through Ways and Means, and I believe Ways and Means has secured money, at least I hope they have, on 408 as it was, and now we've got another amendment and we're worried about that. But I think it's important for you to hear why we disagree with the Judicial Department about this point. The good news, though, is that we agree on almost everything else in the bill. Well, we do agree on everything else in the bill. So Connie and Linda will take you through this and give you the policy considerations to look at from our point of view.
Okay. Chair Shetterly and members of the committee, I'm Connie Gallagher, Special Assistant to the Director for the State Office for Services for Children and Families. And I'm here to testify in opposition to the amendment proposed today because it does not add a positive element to the process of expediting permanency for children or assuring their safety and well-being. Quite to the contrary, we believe that it is going to increase the likelihood of appeal and litigation delays. It also, as Mr. Mink stated, will require an additional hearing for some 1,800 children, and it moves a casework decision into the adversarial court process. You'll see in the testimony that's being distributed three key reasons why this amendment should not be supported, and I'd like to just very briefly go through those. The first and the most important, as Representative Erbelow has mentioned, is the issue of whether it will assist in moving children into permanent homes or not. Is it good for children? We contend that the proposed amendments, which require a court finding, not just a review, a court finding as to whether an exception exists to the mandate to file a petition for termination of parental rights, is a very different issue than whether the court should make a determination on the merits of termination. We believe that the decision whether to file should be left up to the parties, as are most other filing matters that come in front of the court. AFSA does, of course, provide parameters for the agency and for the parties in guiding that decision. We also certainly agree with the court that the decision whether to actually terminate a person's parental rights is a court decision. unnecessary time and resources, we believe, will be spent litigating whether or not to simply file that petition, not whether the termination itself is in a child's best interest. Also, allowing the court to rule on whether a petition should be filed will create additional issues that any party can and will appeal. We have now had 2 years of experience implementing Senate Bill 689 and the rebuttable presumption findings that are a part of 689. What we have found is an increasing number of contested case hearings and longer hearings, and we have no reason to doubt that that trend will change if we add another finding. We would expect additional time spent in the courtroom for our caseworkers. This will result in delays for children and will take away resources that could be spent in providing services to families. As Mr. Mink has indicated, we do believe that there are unplanned costs associated with the amendment, and I will explain in a little more detail why we think there are costs. Unlike Senate Bill 689, ASFA and Senate Bill 408 are retroactive and require that the agency move quickly on all cases where a child has been in care 15 months or more. So the scenario that Mr. Travis just relayed to you around the permanency hearing, that takes place at 12 months. What we have are 3,700 children who have been in care over 15 months. So they have missed the point of that permanency hearing, the normal course of events. So that puts them in a different category. We looked at these 3,700 kids and determined that most of them, fortunately, are already in their permanent homes and have already had much of the legal work to accomplish their finalization. So we do not anticipate that this entire number of 3,700 would require an additional hearing, but conservatively, we do estimate that there are about 1,800 children whose case would require a hearing. The costs for this are estimated at $299,000, and that's without consideration of appeals or litigation costs.
Let me ask you, $299,000, is that cost you determined to SCF, or are those Judicial Department costs? Those are SCF costs?
Mr. Chair, those are the costs just to the agency, the cost for caseworker time. The third point I would like to make is that the proposed amendment seems to eliminate agency discretion and grant authority in a way that was not intended by Congress. And this is the point, again, that Representative Verbilow was addressing. You'll see on the back of my testimony the congressional history of the language to which we're referring. And it shows that there was deliberate consideration given to requiring the court to make a determination whether there's a compelling reason not to file for TPR. And you can see through the progression of the changes that ultimately they decided to delete this language. The language on page 2 of my testimony clearly describes the intent of the final language. And again, it is true that it's in the comment section, but I believe when you put that together with the congressional history regarding the language, there is reason to believe that the comments pertain to what happened as Congress progressed with this bill. This bill had tremendous support in Congress. They were united in their desire to design a bill that was very proactive in pursuing the goals of safety and permanency for children. It seems that in addition to recognizing through their final language that the court determination may be a burden to states, that they also recognize that it certainly is not essential and, in fact, may inhibit achieving the desired goals for children. The last thing I would like to say is that implementation of the Adoption Safe Families Act and Senate Bill 408 will require a great many changes for all aspects of the human services system. We would like to suggest that the initial efforts should be directed towards assuring that the required aspects of ASFA are met by the courts, the legal community, the treatment community, and certainly SCF. We have a great deal of work to do in order to expedite permanency for children. If there are changes that would improve the system, the state would be in a much better position 2 years from now, having gained additional experience and having received the final federal rules, which have not yet been issued, to make the right changes for meeting the goals of safety and permanency for our children. And at this point, there are some legal issues that I believe Ms. Gus from the Attorney General's office will address.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Shetterly and members of the committee. I'm in somewhat of a unique position this afternoon because I was first asked by the State Office of Services to Children and Families to appear with them to simply answer any questions or provide some information to the committee regarding legal issues that the office may have raised. However, since that request was made, I have been asked to appear on behalf of the Department of Justice as well to express the concerns and questions that our office has, which are raised by this additional amendment. So I'm going to speak to you this afternoon, and some of the comments that I make will really be similar to or in reference to the comments that Ms. Gallagher and Mr. Mink have already made, but I will be raising some additional comments also. I would like to apologize that I really didn't have time to prepare written testimony. I didn't have sufficient notice, but I would like to provide some written testimony at a later date. As I mentioned, I am an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice, and I am assigned to work in the Human Services section of the General Counsel Division. I provide ongoing advice to the State Office of Services to Children and Families. I have a background, 7 years of prosecuting termination of parental rights cases, my primary responsibility being down the I-84 corridor to the Idaho border. So I have extensive experience in litigating the very difficult cases that arise when a decision to terminate is made. I was the attorney out on a monthly basis, staffing cases in the offices, trying to make decisions about whether or not it was appropriate to seek a termination action in a case. I also have 7 years of experience as a juvenile court counselor, which certainly prepared me for much of the work I do, and I wanted to let you know about that experience. Every player in the juvenile court system plays a vitally important role, and we certainly recognize the importance of the role of the court as, among other things, fact finder, the resolver of disputes, and sometimes a taskmaster. But the responsibilities and duties of the players in the juvenile court system really have to be balanced. The concerns that the Department of Justice has is that the amendments may create or increase unnecessary delays in achieving permanency for children. The amendment, I believe, signals a fundamental change in who makes the decision about whether a petition should be filed, not whether a parent's rights should be terminated, but merely the decision to actually initiate the filing of a petition. Although ASFA places very clear parameters on when a petition must be filed and the timing of the petition, it does not suggest that it is the court's responsibility to make that decision. Instead, the language that we've been talking about today from the Adoption and Safe Families Act instead suggests that it is really within the agency's discretion to make that decision. We have a concern that there would be increased litigation at the trial level and corollary appeals when people litigate whether or not there's a compelling reason to file a termination. Parents may object to the finding and would, in fact, litigate that. The state may be urging the court to conclude that there is no compelling reason not to file, and so the adversarial process taking its normal course can result in increased and additional litigation. In every case where the state seeks to rely on an exception to the mandate to seek termination, there will have to be a court hearing. And in many, many cases, that hearing or that process, that finding, can happen at a routinely scheduled hearing. So there would not be a specially scheduled hearing. However, the parent could seek an additional hearing for the court to inquire as to whether there is a compelling reason not to terminate. if the state decides to terminate at an earlier date than the permanency hearing, that might also provide some motivation to the parent to ask for a hearing for the court to inquire as to whether or not the state should really be moving forward on a termination. In addition, because of the heightened interest at stake, I think that these hearings are more often going to be contested. As Ms. Gallagher noted, we are already seeing an increase in the number of contested hearings within the rebuttable presumption process, and I think that we can predict that we will have a continuing increase in the number of hearings, and the nature of the hearings will become even more hotly contested. A finding by the court that there is a compelling reason not to file may actually preclude another party, the child and the child's attorney, from moving forward with the filing of a petition if the child and the child's attorney believe it would be in the child's best interest to seek termination. Sometimes it is the child's advocate that wants to terminate parental rights, and a finding by the court in a circumstances described in this amendment would preclude that child's attorney, for all purposes, I think, practical purposes, from proceeding with a termination action. In addition, as I noted, I think that there would be an increase in the number of appeals, perhaps by both sides, if SCF felt it was really in a child's best interest to seek termination and the court had found that there was a compelling reason not to file, the state could, in fact, appeal that. On the other side, if the parent opposed the termination action, which more often, more likely, certainly they do, then that parent would appeal that finding, that there is no compelling reason to seek termination. I have reviewed the legislative history, and I provided much of that to Ms. Gallagher. And in response to Judge Darling, I think she's absolutely correct that the legislative enactments certainly just set the floor. They establish a minimum. And it really is a policy decision for the state of Oregon about whether they should establish stricter guidelines, more requirements where termination should be filed. But one of the concerns that I have identified, and I think it's in response to Representative Uberlau's question, is that the Adoption and Safe Families Act sets very clear guidelines about the cases in which a termination must be filed. The state must include at least those cases. The state can add more, but the state cannot do less. I submit that the same is true for the exceptions. The state must comply with only those exceptions that are laid out by the Adoptions and Safe Families Act. To enact additional exceptions would be contrary to AFSA. And one of the questions I have is in looking at the Adoption and Safe Families Act exceptions, Judicial Department, in fact, in line with the specific exceptions authorized by the Adoption and Safe Families Act? Or does it put a twist on or change in an ever so slight way what the exception is? And let me explain. The Adoption and Safe Families Act says that the state must file a termination petition in three different instances unless, and let me focus on the second exception, the office has documented in the case plan, which shall be available for court review, a compelling reason for determining that the filing of the petition would not be in the child's best interest. It is my understanding that the amendment is intended to give to the court the authority to determine whether the reason is compelling. Now, maybe I misunderstand or misperceive the intent, but when we talk about the review of the documentation, And the folks who testified earlier talked about the scope of the review and the court needing to review those, that documentation. What is the scope of that review? Is the scope of the review to be sure that the office has made all the proper inquiries, has looked for the parents if they're unable to locate them, has looked at alternative plans for the child, is in compliance with its own administrative rules, and has considered what is in fact in the best interest of the child? Is it the court's job to determine whether in fact a compelling interest is proven, or is it the court's role to simply look at whether the office has documented a compelling reason? It's the scope of the review that I think is at issue here.
May I ask a question?
Yes, please? You sure can.
So, is what you're saying that the agency or the police officer, somebody, since the scope of the review should be limited to reading the documentation to see if the agency has done what it should? Is that what you're saying?
That is what it appears that was intended by AFSA, yes. And I take that from the progression of the legislative history that Ms. Gallagher talked about, and the comments in the commentary.
Another question, please. Well, first of all, I have to say I have been living with this issue for three terms, and it's rather a complex issue, and I don't know that I'll ever fully understand it. In fact, I think it could be made much more simple than it is. But that being said, if you go back to Section 15, where we talk about a permanency hearing, we say if the case plan is to, we're talking about reuniting the family, okay? And it says the court shall make certain determinations. So they are looking at the case plan, but they're looking at it for permanency, for something other than to make sure that the agency has crossed all its T's and dotted all its I's. And in fact, as it goes through, this determination the court has to make. My question is, certainly a plan to reunify the family, to me at least, is on no greater level than what we're doing in Section, 28.1. So why would you not expect the court to look at the plan and review it and make a determination, just like it does in permanency, as to whether there is compelling reasons? Not to review it to make sure all the T's are crossed and the I's dotted, but are there compelling reasons? I don't understand why you think there should be different levels with those two different procedures.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Uberlau, I think I would say that is in fact the question, and AFSA is not entirely clear on its face. And we've been anxiously awaiting some clarification through some rules, and you do identify, and I believe that Mr. Travis spoke to, one of the issues that has created the lack of clarity for us in terms of the respective roles of both the state agency and the court. One of the ways to talk about the scope of the court's review and a discussion about what the extent of that review should be might best be described with an example. If the state concludes that it would not be in the best interest of the child to seek a termination, there is some fundamental basis. The child has very strong ties with their birth family, and maybe that child is a 14-year-old child whose permission to adopt must be secured. And SCF documents that and indicates that would be a compelling reason. And the Attorney General's Office or the legal counsel for SCF evaluates that case and says, you're correct, there probably is no legal basis here on which we could file and sustain a petition to terminate parental rights. Does or should the court have the authority to say to FCF, essentially, we disagree. we think that there is no compelling reason, and despite your evaluation of the case and despite the advice of what your legal counsel has told you, we find no compelling reason for you not to terminate. Now, the example I give might be one that's pretty clear that there would be a compelling reason, but there are very different opinions between all of the players, I think, in the juvenile court system about what the role is that the court should play and the extent of the court review and the authority of the court to direct the filing of a termination. And I guess I'll go back to that we're not talking about whether to terminate, we're talking about whether someone gets to file a petition.
Or has to file.
Let me, okay, go ahead, yeah.
Just follow up to that. Well, again, I'm trying to contrast the permanency hearing with the termination hearing. The determination the court makes in the permanency is they are basically second-guessing the agency. They are saying, has the parent made sufficient progress, for example, to make it possible? Well, the court is doing the same thing there as they would do here. They are going and second-guessing. The agency obviously thinks that they have, and so otherwise they wouldn't bring this case plan to reunify him. But then the court has to look at it and decide if it agrees that it has. Well, that's what we're asking, I think, in the termination case. And I want to be careful how I say this, because I think the agency does an excellent job with not nearly enough resources. And I think that we can easily see that when we already see they have 3,600 children out there that they haven't been able to complete. And I certainly don't think it's because they've been derelict, but we don't give them the resources. But it never hurts, because we're talking about children here. It never hurts for somebody to take a second look, I think. The agency is very close to the situation, has been very involved in the situation for a long time. Maybe the court's that more neutral party outside there that can look at it fresh. And you do that in the permanency, and I just am not quite clear why it's this big problem in the termination.
Chair Shetterly and Representative Uberlau, I just have a couple comments, and then perhaps Ms. Gallagher would like to comment. One of the differences in the circumstances that the court reviews in terms of reasonable efforts is a retroactive review. What has the agency already done, and we're going to look and make some decision about or evaluate the adequacy of the parent's effort and the adequacy of FCS efforts to assist that parent. The compelling reason determination, I think, has a prospective effect as opposed to a review of what has already happened. And perhaps you don't find that quote compelling in terms of the difference, but that is one significant difference in that it's evaluating the case and making a prospective decision about whether or not FCF could proceed with the filing of a termination.
Well, it's not always prospective. It's one of the compelling reasons is the parent is successfully working. You are looking at the past for that reason.
Representative Shetterly, Representative Uberlau, certainly that is has certainly an aspect of prospective kind of looking into the future with an expectation that there will be success from that parent. And so that certainly does have a prospective piece to it.
Council, Chairman of the Committee, now my understanding is that this child is, in this situation, the child is before the court. Am I correct?
Representative Shetterly, generally, there may be, I think in many cases, there is already going to be a hearing that's routinely scheduled, but that's not necessarily always the case. The permanency hearing at which this finding, I believe, is the Judicial Department intends that this finding be made, that permanency hearing can be requested at any time by any party. So you could have it earlier, you can have multiple hearings. So we have one that's mandated at a certain point of time, but I believe that provision also allows anybody to ask for a hearing at any other time.
So in most circumstances, is the child before the court for any reason?
for a excuse me, Representative Mr. Young. At a particular point, the one hearing that's mandated by AFSCME, yes, there has to be a hearing, and the child is going to, the circumstances of the child are going to be reviewed.
And the child is already under the court's jurisdiction because?
Because there's been a prior finding that the child has been abused or neglected or is somehow otherwise within the jurisdiction of the court at an earlier hearing.
So the child is a ward of the court at this stage?
Mr. Young, yes, that's correct.
Chairman of the committee, one further question, if I could. My understanding on the federal law is that if we don't comply, then we lose federal funds as it relates to foster care. Is that correct?
Mr. Young, that's correct.
Okay. Are you saying that if we adopt this amendment, that we will lose federal funds?
Representative Shetterly, Mr. Young.
It's Taylor.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's just a question that I have raised and other attorneys in our office have considered, whether this creates a different exception. The exception required by AFSCME, one of the exceptions required by AFSCME, is whether the state has documented a compelling reason, which shall be in the case plan, which shall be available for court review, to not file. This exception is the court makes a finding that there's a compelling reason. It's a small difference, and I just raise it as a question from our office about whether or not that's a different exception.
Let me ask, in the testimony that was presented by the Judicial Department that we have here on page 2, it says, as Steve Christian from the National Conference of State Legislatures, who was brought here by committee counsel to make a presentation to you, said, I do remember that joint hearing where we had the videotape, every other state's conforming language embodies this kind of oversight. Do you agree or disagree with that statement?
Chair Shetterly, I have had an opportunity to review the legislation from a number of other states, and I've also reviewed a summary that the National Conference of State Legislatures prepared on legislation enacted by other states. And those other states have enacted a variety of different provisions. Some have enacted no provisions in statute to address this. I learned from an assistant attorney general in Washington that this issue is dealt with by administrative rule, as he represents. Some states, as I understand the summary, have adopted identical language from the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which is currently represented in the bill without the amendment. I haven't looked at all of the other legislation out there from all the other states, but I think states have done different things.
I'd be curious, could you get counsel or the committee a copy of that NCSF
summary?
I think that'd be helpful to see what's going on out there.
Mr. Chair?
No, we're not going to go into work session. I want to spend some time digesting this. Representative Werbelow, we're in work session. The question is, are we going to take up a vote? And I'm not inclined. Representative Werbelow.
Thank you. I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm a little bit concerned that we had dropped on us here today that there might be this impact of our losing federal money. We have been dealing with federal law now for 5 or 6 years in children issues and support enforcement and so forth. And every time we've asked that question of the Department of Justice, and I'm talking about support enforcement, they've been able to go pick up the phone, call the people and say, if we do it this way, would we lose federal money? I think it could have been done the same way this time, and to come and kind of throw this scare and say, well, we might lose federal money, is rather disturbing to me. I mean, either we do or we don't, and if we do, that tells us where we can't go. If we don't, then we make another decision.
Representative Shetterly, Representative Rubelau, I know, and I've been certainly party to innumerable conversations with the federal representatives to clarify and confirm whether or not the language of Senate Bill 408 complies with the federal mandates. And my last recollection is that the bill, as it currently appears, we have been assured that it does comply.
But the question is, would the new language do anything? That's the question.
And I believe I saw that new language day before yesterday, so I appreciate the comment.
Ms. Gallagher, do you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wibble-Lau, we'd be happy to continue to try to call Region 10. As Ms. Gus said, we only had this 2 days ago. Also, the circumstances now are a little bit different in that they have not published the final rules on ASFA. So many of the questions that we have asked have come back with, well, I think, but I'm not sure. So I'm sorry if you hear that from us. You may hear it again from the feds as well.
Let's wrap this up. I wanted to get an overview of it because it is a thorny issue. And give us some time to take a look at what the summary might be and see if council can enlighten us or if anybody else has anything that comes in between now and Wednesday. I think we'll have to make a decision on Wednesday as to how we go.
And if we could have a fiscal, if it's there, and it might not be, but I think if we could have something definitive, that
I'll talk to council about that as well. Mr. Travis, we'll save your rebuttal for Wednesday if you wanted to testify further about that, since we won't be doing anything with this today anyway. But I do appreciate the overview, and I understand it's a thorny issue. I think we're all after the same thing. It's just a question we want to make sure we get there and we do it without jeopardizing our status with the feds. I'm sorry, Representative Walker?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, are we going to be doing anything with the A-10 amendment?
Yes, those are conflict amendments. We'll move those in when we do the bill.
They're just purely...
Just conflict amendments,
yeah. Right.
All right. Thank you, everybody. With that, I think we will close the work session and stand adjourned for the week, and everybody have a good weekend.